Good morning. This is Linda, and I'm going to be reading today's Decatur Herald Review, September 23rd, 2016. We're going to begin with a story, City Explores Ways to Protect Central Park. Decatur. During the downtown streetscape renovations several years ago, the city invested heavily in Central Park. The site of many concerts and festivals, the park is a popular spot for lunch picnics, evening strolls, and playing the smartphone game Pokemon Go. In addition to the signature fountain and transfer house, it houses cheerful red tables and benches, plenty of shady trees, a stage with rotating pergolas, and even a water fountain with a bowl for dogs. But the jewel of downtown has always attracted damage and vandalism, an expensive and time-consuming problem, especially when city resources are stretched thin. City staff members are now exploring ways to curb this issue. The residents of this community and the users of downtown want and deserve what we've provided, Assistant City Manager Billy Tyrus said. We need to make sure that we figure out a way to allow for use of that, but also figure out a way to address some of the vandalism and other problems that happen. After a motion from the Councilman Pat McDaniel, city staff proposed closing the park and nearby Water Street Plaza from 10 p.m. to 8 a.m. I'm sorry, to 6 a.m. So that would be 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. The Decatur City Council voted 5-2 to table that motion August 15th after hearing from residents who objected, particularly those who said they had formed a community of late-night Pokemon players. Tyus and Public Works Director Rick Marley said the curfew proposal had nothing to do with the Pokemon players, who began showing up en masse to the park after the game was released in July. We've been dealing with this for quite some time, Marley said. Frankly, I never heard of this Pokemon thing until after we started talking about the curfew. So what kind of damage do city workers encounter? Marley said the vandalism takes many forms and varies in severity from day to day. People bathe in the fountain, sometimes using soap or leaving their clothes behind, he said. They skateboard on the furniture, etch their initials into the metal tables, and leave all kinds of trash on the ground. Branches have been broken off trees, sprinkler heads broken out of the ground. And then there are the bodily fluids. Marley said people have defecated near the concrete benches surrounding the transfer house. Urine appears to be more often, and vomit shows up quite frequently. It's rude and crude stuff, but somebody's got to clean that up, Marley said. It really is hard to deal with. One possibility is the consider being considered is the installation of cameras in the park, Tyrus said. Some council members suggested additional police presence could be helpful. Patrol Officer Eric Wagoner said the Decatur Police Department has increased directed patrols in the area over the past few months. Officers look for any signs of intoxication, people passed out on the benches or in the fountain, and other behaviors that could be addressed by issuing a city or state ordinance violation. Particularly during the overnight and early morning hours is when a lot of this occurs, so third shift patrol particularly has paid more attention to it, Wagner said. That's a place where we like to have our presence anyway, with our economic area down there and the downtown district. Some council members also expressed concern for the homeless who might be sleeping and bathing in the park. Tyus said there may be opportunities to reach out and let those individuals know about available resources without placing blame or judgment. Tyus said the city is open to suggestions from the public. He also asked that people who use the park help to preserve it by reporting inappropriate or improper behavior that they observe. I know that that's not always comfortable for people, but we would ask that they do so, he said. Ultimately, the goal is to make sure that the park remains safe and nice for years to come, so that people can and will continue to use it. DMH announces collaboration with Springfield Clinic. Current Springfield Clinic patients in Decatur will soon be seeing their doctors at a new building. The hope is that the change, moving from HSHS St. Mary's Hospital campus to Decatur Memorial's hospitals, is in the renovated 14,000 square foot office building at 250 West Kenwood Avenue, will eventually mean an expansion of Springfield Clinic's specialty services in Decatur. DMH President and CEO Tim Stone announced the addition for DMH at a Thursday news conference in the Barnes lobby. Construction is still in progress at the building on Kenwood, but Springfield Clinic Chief Operating Officer Jay York said he's targeting mid to late November for the building to be ready for patients. York said, while on the surface, this looks like Springfield Clinic switching allegiances from St. Mary's to DMH, that isn't the case. He said the move keeps the Springfield Clinic from having to build new construction, but offers it room to grow. The reality is that the current practice on the St. Mary's campus is spatially constrained, and we really can't grow there, York said. We had been looking at other areas in town, and this is going to allow us to spread out and add more services. Our discussions about those services are currently ongoing, but we've been clear with St. Mary's. This isn't us saying that we don't want to work with them in the future. We're here to serve the community as a whole. Springfield Clinic's Decatur family medicine doctors moving to the new office are John DiMondo, Dennis Heim, Cynthia Marshner, Dennis Rademacher, Tammy Buzan, Mercedes Kent, Nicole Mason, Jennifer Norton, and Sarah O'Brien. Specialties are adult and pediatric endocrinology, neurology, rheumatology, and adult and pediatric dermatology. It's just a different location for them. We hope to retain all their patients, York said. We're not hospital-based, and if you think about the way healthcare is today, physicians aren't aligned with one hospital to where if you see them, you have to go to that hospital. St. Mary's Director of Marketing, Jessica Michael, said Springfield Clinic informed St. Mary's of its decision to move Thursday morning. She had said St. Mary's would work to make sure patients' needs are met during the transition. It affects a few primary care physician offices, but we will continue to have Springfield Clinic physicians on our medical staff, including specialists who routinely care for patients at St. Mary's, Michael said. We welcome physicians and physician groups from across the region to practice at our hospital. Michael said the hospital expects to lease the space being vacated to other physicians. For DMH, this was the next step in the business model Stone brought to the DMH Board of Directors when he became the hospital's president and CEO last year. Both myself and the other members of our executive leadership team are convinced collaborations afford us the greatest opportunity to survive and thrive in the age of the Affordable Care Act, which has encouraged merging, Stone said. This is an example of two healthcare entities with a common vision coming together to maximize resources and value to the patients and communities we serve. Stone said once the location is expanded to offer more specialty services, it will help the reverse the out-migration of patients to hospitals in other communities, which he said constituted $278 million in business. This will increase access in our community for patients needing family medicine and specialty services, negating the need to travel out of town and putting a dent in out-migration, Stone said. The building the Springfield Clinic is moving into was formerly the DMH Family Residency Program, which has moved into the Kenwood Medical Center, also undergoing renovation to expand because of DMH's collaboration with SIU School of Medicine. The collaboration with Springfield Clinic is just the latest for DMH. In February, DMH joined the BJC Collaborative, which aligned DMH with seven other regional hospitals, including Barnes Jewish Hospital in St. Louis. The collaborative allows members to remain independent but band together to save money on equipment and supplies, improve access to health care a patient might need elsewhere, and become more efficient with new Medicare and Medicaid payment methods that demand it. The Springfield Clinic is the second largest physician-led multi-specialty group in Illinois. It has more than 400 doctors and advanced practitioners in 80 medical specialties or subspecialties in 40 locations spanning 20 counties. The Illinois Department of Human Services will hold hearings next month on its plan to prohibit overtime for workers who provide in-home care for people with disabilities. The department implemented the policy in May in response to a U.S. Department of Labor ruling that said home care workers must earn time and a half overtime pay if they work for more than 40 hours per week. However, Governor Bruce Rauner's administration put the policy on hold last month, just as a union representing 25,000 home care workers was readying to file a class action lawsuit challenging it. Terry Harkin, a vice president with Service Employees International Union Healthcare Illinois, said the union believes the administration acted illegally in implementing the restriction. While the department is now seeking permission from the General Assembly's bipartisan, bicameral committee in charge of approving such rules, Harkin said SEIU still believes its actions are against the law. The state has an obligation to bargain with the union over policy changes, she said, adding that the union has filed an unfair labor practices claim with the Illinois Labor Relations Board. Even if it weren't illegal to implement this because of the bargaining obligation, they still shouldn't do it, Harkin said. It's very harmful to literally thousands of people with disabilities and some of the lowest paid workers in the state. Personal assistants in the department's home services program earn $13 an hour, and Rauner vetoed legislation this summer that would have raised their pay to $15 an hour. The union and the administration have been negotiating a new contract for more than a year, and the administration has pushed for a pay freeze. The Department of Human Services did not respond Thursday to a request for comment, but Secretary James DeMoss told the Associated Press last month that the policy was designed to save the state money and protect personal assistants from working too many hours. Previously, we had people working 17 to 20 hours a day, DeMoss told the AP. I don't think people are very fresh and responsive if they put in that kind of schedule. A department official who testified about the policy this spring before an Illinois House committee assured lawmakers that it would not be implemented in a draconian manner. Ginger Grant of Charleston works for a 67-year-old woman with multiple sclerosis who is approved for nearly 60 hours of care per week. The woman already had a second personal assistant who filled in when Grant wasn't available. When the new policy went into effect, the woman had to find a third assistant to pick up the extra hours Grant could no longer work. Grant said that has meant the woman can no longer call her if she needs help with something like going to the bathroom in the middle of the night. I had to cut back or I would be fired, she said, noting that her pay had dropped about $200 to $300 per month. Harkin said that not all clients have been able to find extra help so easily. The turnover rate for the home care workers is nearly 50% annually, she said. The department will hold hearings on the policy October 3rd in Chicago and October 6th in Springfield. Estranged husband arrested in 1990, murder of nurse. This is from Monticello. Gregory J. Hauser was arrested Thursday in connection with the death of Cheryl Hauser, 29, a nurse who was found dead on the floor of her garage with a rope tied around her neck in rural Piatt County almost 26 years ago. Hauser, 56, Cheryl's estranged husband at the time of her death, has been charged with four counts of first-degree murder in Piatt County Circuit Court. He is facing 20 to 60 years in prison if convicted. His arraignment is expected to be held at about 9 a.m. Monday. The charges were filed early Thursday by Piatt County State's Attorney Dana Rhodes. Although Hauser was a suspect from the outset, investigators thought it was a staged suicide. The case went cold after a coroner's jury ruled the death as undetermined. But new evidence was recently discovered, including that a condom found just inside the garage contained DNA from Cheryl and Gregory Hauser. Recent DNA technology was a key element in moving forward with the case. Another coroner's inquest was held July 8th. This time, the jury ruled the death a homicide, opening the door for the prosecution of Hauser. Hauser testified at that inquest, invoking his right to remain silent to all questions. Forensic pathologist Dr. Scott Denton reviewed materials related to the case in 2011. His findings presented at the inquest were that Cheryl Hauser died from strangulation with an attempt to conceal the cause of death by staging a hanging from the ceiling. Although the case has been considered cold because of extraordinary length of time involved, the Illinois State Police, the lead investigating agency, has never closed its investigation. Hauser, who was 30 at the time of his wife's death, was awaiting trial on charges of criminal sexual assault for allegedly tying Cheryl to a bed with nylon rope and raping her in September 20th of 1990, 15 days before her death. He was free on bond the morning first responders found Cheryl Hauser on the floor of her attached garage located on her property between Mahomet and Mansfield. Emergency crews were sent to the scene when she failed to show up for her work shift at Carl Foundation Hospital. Hauser is being held without bond in the Piatt County. Protesters out in Charlotte for third night, but stay peaceful. Charlotte, North Carolina. Protesters massed on Charlotte's streets for a third night Thursday in the latest sign of mounting pressure for police to release video that could resolve widely different accounts of the shooting of a black man. Demonstrators chanted, "Release the tape," and "We want the tape," while briefly blocking an intersection near the Bank of America headquarters and later climbing the steps in front of the city government center. Still, the protesters remained peaceful in the hours after night fell, and a midnight curfew imposed by the mayor aimed to add a firm stopping point for the demonstrations. Members of the National Guard carrying rifles were also deployed in front of office buildings to head off another night of violence in this city on edge. So far, police have resisted releasing police dash cam and body camera footage of the death of a 43-year-old Keith Lamont Scott earlier this week. His family was shown the footage Thursday and demanded that police release it to the public. The family's lawyer said he couldn't tell whether Scott was holding a gun. But Charlotte Mecklenburg Police Chief Kerr Putney said earlier in the day that releasing the footage of Scott's killing could undermine the investigation. He told reporters the video will be made public when he believes there's a compelling reason to do so. "You shouldn't expect it to be released," Putney said. "I'm not going to jeopardize the investigation." Charlotte Mayor Jennifer Roberts waited until Thursday's protests were underway for more than an hour before signing documents for the citywide curfew that runs from midnight to 6 a.m. The curfew will last for multiple days until officials determine the emergency has passed. In an interview with CNN, Roberts said she thought the curfew was the most effective way to maintain peace in the city. Charlotte is the latest U.S. city to be shaken by protests and recriminations over the death of a black man at the hands of police, a list that includes Baltimore, Milwaukee, Chicago, New York, and Ferguson, Missouri. In Tulsa, Oklahoma, on Thursday, prosecutors charged a white officer with manslaughter for killing an unarmed black man on a city street last week. In Charlotte, scores of rioters Wednesday night attacked reporters and others, set fires, and smashed windows of hotels, office buildings, and restaurants in the city's bustling downtown section. The NASCAR Hall of Fame was among the places damaged. 44 people were arrested after Wednesday's protests, and one protester who was shot died at the hospital Thursday. City officials said police did not shoot the man, and no arrests have been made in the 26-year-old Justin Carr's death. Police have said Scott was shot to death Tuesday by a black officer after he disregarded loud, repeated warnings to drop his gun. Neighbors, though, have said he was holding only a book. The police chief said a gun was found next to the dead man and there was no book. Putney said that he has seen the video and it does not contain absolute definitive evidence that would confirm that a person was pointing a gun. But he added, when taken into the totality of all the other evidence, it supports what we said. Justin Bamberg, an attorney for Scott's family, watched the video with the slain man's relatives. He said Scott gets out of his vehicle calmly. While police did give him several commands, he did not aggressively approach them or raise his hands at members of law enforcement at any time. It is impossible to discern from the videos what, if anything, Mr. Scott is holding in his hands, Bamberg said in a statement. Scott was shot as he walked slowly backward with his hands by his side, Bamberg said. The lawyer said at a news conference earlier in the day that Scott's wife saw him get shot, and that's something she will never ever forget. That is the first time anyone connected with the case has said the wife witnessed the shooting. Bamberg gave no details on what the wife saw. Roberts, who also watched the footage of the shooting, was asked by CNN whether he saw Scott holding a gun. It is not a very clear picture, and the gun in question is a small gun, and it was not easy to see. So it is ambiguous, she replied. Experts who track shootings by police noted that the release of the videos can often quell protest violence, and that the footage sometimes shows that events unfolded differently than the official account. What we've seen in too many situations now is that the videos tell the truth and the police who were involved in the shooting tell lies, said Randolph McLaughlin, a professor at Pace University School of Law. He said it is irresponsible of police not to release the video immediately. Other cities have released footage of police shootings. Just this week, Tulsa police let the police see video of the disputed September 16th shooting, though the footage left important questions unanswered. The police chief acknowledged that he has promised transparency in the investigation, but said, "I'm telling you right now, if you think I say we should display a victim's worst day for consumption, that is not the transparency I'm speaking of." Associated Press writers Tom Foreman Jr., Jonathan Drew, Sandra Adcox, Jeffrey Collins, Jack Jones, and Gary Robertson contributed to this report. Supreme Court overturns law cutting civil juries to six. Springfield. The Illinois Supreme Court struck down a law Thursday that reduced the size of civil juries from 12 members to six, finding that the writers of the state constitution had intended to guarantee larger juries when they adopted the current charter in 1970. Justices voted 5-0 to overturn a 2014 law that determined six jurors should hear civil cases. It was an effort to increase pay for jurors, taking time away from jobs and families by spreading the compensation pool among half as many people. Two justices did not take part in the decision. The case in question involved a man and a woman who filed a medical negligence suit against five doctors and their employers. The defendants in the case filed a lawsuit arguing the law, which took effect in June of 2015, violates the right of trial by jury and separation of powers among branches of government. Chief Justice Rita Garman noted in writing the court's opinion that both the U.S. and Illinois constitutions protect the right of trial by jury, but that the court gives more weight to the state document. It guarantees the right of trial by jury as heretofore enjoyed, and the justices concluded that means to preserve the practice of 12-person juries. There is ample evidence that the draft, there is ample evidence that the drafters at the 1970 Constitutional Convention believed they were specifically preserving the right to a 12-person jury when they adopted the current Constitution, Garman wrote. Transcripts from the Constitutional Convention debates disclose that the delegates did not believe that the legislature had the authority to reduce the size of a civil jury prior to the 1970 convention. The Democratic-controlled Illinois General Assembly okayed the change in late 2014, just before Republican Bruce Rauner became governor. Advocates argue more pay means drawing jurors from a wide cross-section of the community. Trial lawyers say they're not getting jurors representative of that community. Opponents claim strong personalities can dominate smaller juries and lead to inconsistent verdicts. And in Illinois, Republicans derided the idea as a benefit to Democrat-leaning trial lawyers because smaller juries tend to award more money in damages. The court's opinion invalidated the entire law, including the higher pay provision. Find must have been fate. This is from Bloomington. When Tom Riddle set the air brakes on his semi-truck at the Pilot truck stop in Bloomington last week, his partner was ready to go, literally. The Independence, Missouri man travels with Karma, the family's miniature pincher. When he opened the door, Karma took off, chasing a rabbit under a fence at the neighboring impound lot at Brown's Wrecker Service. "I looked as long as I could," said Riddle, but his schedule as a driver for night transportation forced him to leave his dog behind. He contacted McLean County animal control officials, who suggested he work with a volunteer group, Lost and Found Pets of McLean County. The group also runs a Facebook page, Lost Found Pets in Bloomington Normal, as a place for people to share information. In the days after her escape, Karma had been seen crossing West Market Street and running into a motel parking lot in search of food, or perhaps a rabbit. Her 4 days on the loose ended September 15th, when about seven volunteers finally cornered Karma. She had been spotted in the impound lot, and volunteers blocked holes in the bottom of a chain-link fence to keep her in until Brown's Wrecker Service employee Jake Erdman finally made the caller. Karen Smith of Bloomington, a member of the group, kept Karma overnight until Riddle could make it back the next day. "She's been great," Smith said of her unexpected guest. Back at Pilot, to wait for Riddle, Karma pulled at her two leashes as each truck pulled in or out of the lot, expecting it to be Riddle's. "I cannot thank you guys enough. It's incredible that a group of total strangers went out of the way to help her," said Riddle, whose 6-year-old daughter Kendall and 10-year-old son Blaine were on the phone with him after the reunion. Six of the volunteers gathered to watch Karma reunite with her owner and head for her 18-wheel home. "You guys have no idea how much this means to us," said Riddle, as he showed a cell phone photo of a lost dog notice made by his son. "It makes you realize how good people." We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald Review. Please stay tuned.